Okay, this is Mary Kay Downey, and it's November the 6th, 2010, and I'm here interviewing Danette Harrington. Good afternoon, Danette.
Good afternoon, Mary Kay.
Now, for the record, you have to tell us your full name and tell us where and when you were born.
My full name is Danette Marie Harrington. I was born in Butte, Montana, 1944.
And did you grow up in Butte?
I did.
Where have you lived?
I've always lived in Butte, the only place I've ever lived. I was raised in Double Gulch, and I moved after I got married further west to Woolman Street, and I'm still there.
So that, and all in Butte?
All in Butte.
What jobs have you held?
Let's see, when I guess my first jobs were babysitting, and then I went to work for the Grand Silver department store when I was still in high school. Then I worked for Blue Shield Insurance, and then I went to work in the courthouse when I was 19. And I'm still there.
So the next question was, what do you do for a living now?
I work at the courthouse. I'm the elected Butte Silver Bow Auditor.
The elected Butte Silver Bow Auditor. What's Butte Silver Bow?
Butte Silver Bow is our city-county combined into one government.
Okay. And have you ever married?
Yes.
When were you married?
I was married on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 1973.
And was your partner also of Irish ancestry?
No, that's what went wrong.
Do you want to tell us about that?
No.
Do you have any children?
I have two sons.
And how old are they?
Jeff is my oldest son. He just turned 36. Jason is my second son, and he will be 33 on the 17th of November.
And where do they live?
Jeff lives in Butte, Montana, married to Velvet, has two children, Hunter and Peyton. Hunter is 11, Peyton is 6, attend Kennedy School. Jason lives and teaches school in Helena, Montana. He teaches wood, drafting, and welding. Unmarried.
And did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I did. I had one brother.
And where did you fall? Were you older or younger?
I was younger.
And who was your brother?
James Harrington.
And what did James Harrington do?
He was a boiler maker for the Anaconda Company, and then when the mines closed, he went to work for Butte Silver Bow on the Metro Sewer Maintenance Crew.
So he too lived in Butte?
He did, all of his life.
And now tell me about your parents. What are your parents' names?
My mother was Margaret Page Harrington. My father was Daniel Patrick Harrington.
And were your mom and dad from Ireland?
No.
Where were they born?
They were born in Butte.
And were their parents from Ireland?
Yes.
When did your ancestors, who were your ancestors? Tell me the four of them if you know.
You know, my grandparents on my dad's side were Mary and Pete Harrington. And on my mother's side, it was Hannah and James Francis Page.
And do you know where Pete Harrington was from in Ireland?
They were from Castletown Bear, a little road called Clontreen, outside of the city almost.
Do you know when Pete Harrington came to Montana?
I don't.
Do you know if he came directly to Montana from Ireland?
As far as I know, he did.
Did he come to Montana already married to Mary?
That I can't answer you. I don't know. He died in 1914.
He died in 1914?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you didn't know him at all?
I did not know him.
Okay. How many children did Pete and Mary have? How many brothers?
10.
Mm-hmm. Are they all in Butte?
No, they all, except the only two that stayed in Butte during my lifetime was my Aunt Jewel McHugh and my father. The rest of them all relocated to San Francisco.
So was Jewel and your father?
Brother and sister.
Okay. Okay. And how about Hannah and James Page? Did they also come from Ireland?
I believe they were probably born here, or I think James Page I'm not sure. My grandmother was an O'Brien, Hannah O'Brien Page. Not sure where she was born, but James F. Page was born in Pennsylvania, so they came to Butte through Pennsylvania.
And you know if they were married when they got to Butte?
I don't.
Okay. Do you have any photographs of your, these would be your great-grandparents,
mm-hmm,
right?
I do.
Well, good. If you could send me a copy.
Okay.
All right. Now, do you know anything about their lives in Ireland?
I don't know much other than my father telling me stories about how they used to walk from Castletown Bear to the mine in Elahees, and how tough they were and how they were very limited with any kind of food, and it was a cold, very difficult life. If you weren't on the sea, you were in the mine, and it was just a very sparse existence.
Do you know how old he was when he came to the United States?
I don't.
But your father would tell you the stories about mm-hmm. your grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you ever, your grandfather died young. How about Paige? Did he die young too?
You know, I'm not sure. I remember my grandmother. I think James F. Page died after my brother was born, and I think he was probably about 11 or 12 when he died. Then my grandmother Page died when I was probably 4 or 5.
So do you remember her?
I do remember her.
What do you remember about your grandma?
She had a leather cast on her arm, and she sat by the stove when she came to the house. That's where she kind of just perched. And I don't know exactly what was the matter with her arm, but she never left the kitchen. I mean, that's where you entertained, was in the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
Even if you had a bunch of rooms, you didn't go there. You just sat in the kitchen where it was warm. And she sat drinking tea at the in a rocking chair, and this leather cast, and I'm assuming she must have had some kind of a arthritis or something, but it was a leather cast. It was very strange to see that on a person, but I do remember that about her. And she was white-haired, looked a lot like my mother as I remember her as she aged.
And she was Hannah O'Brien. What part of Ireland was Hannah from?
You know, I don't have any clue where the O'Briens, nobody's ever done any research on the Page side.
Have you ever thought about what your Irish ancestry means to you when you think about these grandparents and great-grandparents?
Well, I guess what it means to me is, and I never really associated it until I went to Ireland the first time, and there's just something when you go there that the feeling of being there kind of just cements that that's where your roots are, and it's quite a settling feeling, I think.
What do you know about your family name?
Just how to spell it.
Irish form or the Americanized?
Yeah, do you know an Irish form to the family name?
I don't.
You do too. We took pictures of it. You were sitting in that bar 1 minute.
Are there any stories about the history or the origin of your family name or of your family that you can tell us?
Not that I can pull up, no.
All right, let's talk about your childhood. What are some of your childhood memories in Butte?
Well, I was raised in the Dublin Gulch,
Let me stop you for a minute.
Okay.
Do you know why they called it the Dublin Gulch?
I don't. I guess it was because it was full of Irish people. When my dad was born, and they lived there, and they were a family of 10, and a lot of the families that lived there, I think there was only one other family that had more children than the Harringtons, and they had 15, and I think that was the Currans, if I can remember listening to stories. And there was 80 to 85 houses in the Gulch when my dad was being raised in the Gulch. So they never left the Gulch. I mean, their whole existence was there. They used to market at a store at the bottom of Anaconda Road, but they went to Church of St. Mary's, probably went downtown to Hennessy's Granite Street, but the only time they really left the Gulch as growing up was to go to a funeral or have a party out at Brown's Gulch or something when there was something going on. But they seldom left the neighborhood because that was the whole world to them, was Dublin Gulch.
And were there other nationalities in the Dublin Gulch?
There could have been, but mostly everybody that I remember them talking about were Irish. And there was, you know, when I grew up, there was so few houses. I think there was maybe 14 to 17 houses, and then there was a fire, and it was down to about 9 by the time we left the Gulch. But one of the things I remember definitely about the neighborhood was there was a lot of people that had grandmothers, and then I only had a grandmother for a short period of my life. But there was lots of grandmas that lived in the neighborhood. So we spent a lot of time knowing what a grandmother was, but I didn't really experience one because my grandma died when I was young.
Were there grandfathers as well?
Not many. Mostly just grandmas. I think there were widows. You know, the fathers had died early in life from working in the mine.
So you went to St. Mary's School. That was a Catholic school?
It was.
Tell us about your school experiences.
We used to walk to school, and it was quite a ways. We lived in the Gulch, and we had to go over through almost Corktown, cross the railroad tracks, and go to the school on Wyoming Street, then later moved to the school that was on Main Street, which was like a half a block from the original school. And I think our first grade class probably had about 21, 22 students, and I stayed at St. Mary's right through graduation, eighth grade, and then went on to Butte Central.
Now, you started with 20-some kids in the class?
I think so. I'm not really sure, but there was at least 20-some. I think there was like 10 girls and 11 boys or something most of the year, with some dropping, some adding through the years of grade school.
That's what I was going to ask. Did you stay with the same kids pretty much the whole 8 years?
Pretty much. We had some kids that moved in and out, but the bulk of the kids that I went to school with all stayed in the same neighborhoods. You know, it was mostly from over by the Goodwill on Montana Street, north of Woolman Street was still St. Mary's Parish, and then all around the Nun's House between Montana and Main Street, and then on through to Anaconda Road and up in Dublin Gulch. That was kind of the parish for the boundaries for the school.
And when you say the parish, what do you mean?
St. Mary's Parish was the church and the parish of the Catholic parish.
And so your school boundaries were the same as the parish boundaries?
Yes.
So you went through Corktown to get to Main Street?
Mm-hmm.
What's Corktown?
Corktown was a neighborhood to the west of the Dublin Gulch, and it had a B&P railroad track that went through there. That was a Anaconda Company railroad, and it was on Wyoming, and I guess it would be Clergret Street, which was kind of in the center between the Gulch and Main Street. That was a neighborhood all of its own, kind of right up in there, and they probably had a cluster of maybe 100 to 150 homes at one time.
Why do they call it Corktown, do you know?
Just an Irish name. We had also a hill in the Dublin Gulch that they called Hungry Hill, and that had a lot of homes on it. So I think they were places from Ireland that they called these places once they settled in Butte, because the Irish population was so heavy.
Who named them, these
places? I don't have any idea.
I've often wondered that. So what kind of games did you play when you were a child?
When I was a child, we basically played a lot of guys' games, boys' games, because there wasn't a lot of girls' games. We played baseball with the boys. We played kick the can.
What's that?
Kick the can was you stood around and stacked cans on top of each other and kind of kicked one off, and the person that didn't kick both cans was the winner. If you could kick the top can, you were pretty talented. And then we played...
Did you get pretty agile at that game?
You did. You could pretty well dance on one leg. And we jumped rope. We couldn't play hopscotch because we never had a sidewalk, but you could draw it in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the things that you used to do was, in order to play hopscotch, you had to go look for the shiniest toss to move your place. And you got a really shiny piece of glass or an excellent shiny rock, because that was your toss when you tossed a playing hopscotch. Jumped rope. I can remember jumping rope, double door. Double door was excellent. You could jump rope with a single rope, and then when you got a little bit skilled, you could do the double rope, which was two ropes going opposite directions, and you had to go in the door and out the door, and it was very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Did you used to sing any verses while you did your jump rope?
We probably did, but I can't tell you what it would be. Then we played Holly Go Ranchy and Red Rover. Did a lot of run around the hills, and then we had a swimming pool in the Gulch that never had water in it when I was growing up. And it was owned by Hogarth's grandmother, Linda Hagenbrook. And apparently when I was younger, or maybe when my brother was around, some child was drowned in that pool, so they drained it and never filled it up again. And so Linda still had a bar and a grocery store. And so instead of putting the cans in the garbage, they filled the pool with beer cans. And they were not aluminum cans that were flexible. They were metal cans. And so we didn't have a baseball to play baseball with, so we played beer can baseball. And we played at the field, and when you'd go home, right above your fingernail, on your thumbs, from holding the bat, and the cans would come in and hit you. You went home every night with just bleeding fingers from holding onto the bat, getting hit with the beer cans. But it was great fun, because we didn't have a ball.
Where was this swimming pool?
Over behind, would be Harp O'Neill's and Plexi Olson's, kind of up in the back.
Yeah.
Leona Dennehy's and Beto's were kind of up on the plateau where you come down to go around the corner by Harp O'Neill's. Yeah, so it was pretty amazing. Those were the games we played, basically. But a lot of times when you'd be playing with the boys, they wouldn't let you play ball, but you could be the pigtail, and it was such an honor. And when somebody would, the catcher would miss the ball, the goofy pigtail would have to run down the dump probably about 400 yards to bring the ball back, and you were just so privileged to be able to bring that ball back up the hill because they let you in the game.
The guys in Butte. What kind of home entertainment did you have?
You know, we listened to the radio a lot.
Do you remember some of the shows you listened to?
Yes, we used to listen to Matt Dillon on Saturday mornings, and we listened to the Green Hornet. It was mostly music in the evenings or news when my mother would iron. As I said, we lived in the kitchen. You seldom went in the living room. And so the radio was always on in the kitchen, and that's where we spent our lives, was in the kitchen of the house. The kitchen and the bathroom were the mostly used rooms in our home. We had other rooms, but you just didn't. They weren't heated, so you didn't go there.
So did you ever have TV growing up?
We did. We had TV. The first television in the Gulch was owned by the Maloneys, and they lived two houses down from us. And so we went down to watch when they first got their TV, and it was black and white. And we used to go down, they invited us down to watch Bishop Sheehan. And the night Bishop Sheehan was on, it was just, that was a big gathering of people to go to Maloney's house. And my father loved the little angel that would come out and erase the chalkboard.
Did you ever see the little angel?
No.
Uh-uh.
No, but he'd come out and erase the chalkboard. So that was the first TV. And then we bought our first television at Radio Engineering. And it was black and white, and we had it for years, and it was a council TV. And great monstrosity of a thing. And but it was wonderful. We were just thrilled to have a television. And then everybody bought those colored screens to put on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And the top was blue, and the middle was kind of a green, and the bottom was kind of a red. And it was just a colored rainbow. But man, you thought you were uptown if you could afford that. 99 cents for the screen cover.
And you guys had a screen cover.
We got a screen cover. But we were probably, I think Ida Sullivan had a TV before us and Maloney's. Ours was slow in coming. But in 1956, I can remember also, my mother decided she wanted to remodel the kitchen. And Ida Smith and Myrtle Hartman, who lived next door, they made more money than my dad did. So they had gotten new O'Keefe and Merritt gas ranges. And I mean, they were just Cadillac. And they had chrome tops on them.
Uh-huh.
And so my mother went looking for a stove because she wanted to do her kitchen. So we got a new I think it was called a Youngstown sink that had two sinks in it. Took the one off the wall, got the sink that was a console. It had a drawer on each side and then a doors that opened on the bottom.
Oh.
And I mean, it was just Cadillac. So we got that gorgeous new sink. And then my mother bought a stove, but we couldn't afford the O'Keefe and Merritt. So she had a downgrade to get a Wedgwood. But it had the chrome top, but nothing like the Wedge or the O'Keefe and Merritt's. But then she went to Hennessy's and bought two cabinets that went on each side, and it almost looked like it was a marble top on them. It was plastic of some kind. She was just so proud because Ida didn't have cabinets alongside her stove, and neither did Myrtle Hartman. So her downgrade of stoves was made up with the cabinets that she was able to install. You know, so those are crazy things you remember.
Yeah.
The night my dad was plumbing the sink, we were out playing Holly Go Ranchy, and I fell. We were getting beat to death with dirt bombs. Do you remember dirt bombs?
Well, before I even get to dirt bombs, what's Holly Go Ranchy?
Holly Go Ranchy was just something that you ran through the hills, and you kind of held hands, and then you went screaming up the mountain, and if you didn't break arms, then you were considered pretty good, but the girls were kind of fragile, so we always broke arms. But and then you would just holly, scream and holler, and it was just called Holly Go Ranchy. But we were up this night playing dirt bombs, I guess it was, and we were getting pretty well pummeled with the dirt bombs, and I fell and broke my arm, and my father was plumbing the sink. And I came down and I said, "Geez, Dad, I think I broke my arm." And he had a monkey wrench that was as big as I was. And he says, "Get out of here, I'm going to hit you with this monkey wrench," because the top of his head was bleeding. He was bald. And from working under the sink, there was a bunch of sharp edges, and every time he was in trying to do all this, he had like a halo of red around his head. And he says, "Get out of here." My mother was in paint in the bathroom, and I can remember that vividly. She had all the knobs to the cabinets and pop bottles, and she would paint them all, and she was painting the bathroom when I went in, and so finally she came out, and she said to my dad, she said, "Geez, Dan, I think she did break her arm." So they had to throw me in the tub because I was maggoty from the dirt bombs. So then she went out in the backyard and broke an apple box and set my arm.
Oh, my goodness.
And because it was like a nighttime, you couldn't go to the doctor. So when we finally got to see Dr. McMahon, all he did was throw a cast on it. And so that was the repair of my arm. And probably about 4 years ago, I went to the doctor because I fell out the gate. And he said to me, "Gee, it looks like you've broken this wrist before." And I said, "Well, yeah, I broke it when I was a kid." And he said, "Oh." And I says, "My mother said it." And he said, "Apparently she wasn't a doctor." And I said, "No." And he says, "Look at this." Well, the joint on my wrist is out about 3/4 of an inch from where it should be. I said, "No, she wasn't a doctor, but she fixed it for me."
And you remember the day you broke it?
I do.
What's a dirt bomb?
Dirt bomb is where you pick up weeds out of the ground, and there's a big clump of dirt on the bottom of it, and you used it as a weapon to just throw at somebody that was going by. You could knock them off their shoes because there were some pretty good-sized weeds in the gulch.
The next question here has to do with crafts. Were there crafts that you liked that you were a part of, besides crafting your own toys to throw the dirt at everybody?
No, we didn't have crafts.
Was there storytelling?
There was storytelling. My aunts used to come to the house, and it was an absolute piece of history. We only had the sense to tape it or something, because the sad part about it was, though, they all told stories, and everybody tried to outdo the other one, and nobody really listened. So you might have four people telling stories at the same time, fighting for the opportunity to jump in. And they were wonderful stories about the neighborhood when they grew up, and they really had a tremendous, tremendous life growing up in the Gulch.
Can you remember even the one of them?
I remember them talking about the night that my grandfather died, and it was on Halloween, and they had never seen such food in their lives, and everybody was bringing food and the whole bit. Well, the kids thought it was great. Well, they got so loud because the wake was in our house, and so the noise got so bad that they sent the kids across the street. So they went across the street, and whoever house they were in, they were using the bed for a trampoline, and the kids were having a great time. And I can remember them all saying that it was the best Halloween they ever had. Even though their father had just died, it was a great party.
Now, the whole business of traditions about the wakes and funerals, what do you remember about that in growing up?
I can remember, I think I was teased on a kneeler in Dugan's. We went to Dugan's every Sunday after Mass, whether there was somebody.
What's Dugan's?
Dugan Mortuary on Main Street.
Okay.
And every Sunday after Mass, 9:15 Mass, we would go to Dugan's whether there was a body in there or not. Because my father did not like to drive, hated driving, so we had to go sign the book. He would drive us to church on Sunday. We always went to Dugan's, and they signed a couple blank pages just in case somebody died during the week, so he wouldn't have to go back. So we spent a lot of time in Dugan's talking to Mark and George Perry.
I do.
So people are amazed at how comfortable I am attending wakes. But it was a lifestyle for me. That's what we did every Sunday.
What you said with your grandfather, he was waked at the house?
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
They, instead of going to a mortuary, they held the wakes of the Irish. I'm sure other nationalities did too, but they went ahead and had the wake in the home. And
the body
would be in the house too, and and that's where they all came. And then they had criers and they had shiverings that would take place, and just food. It was a sad time, but it was a celebration because they ended up with more food than they ever saw, because everybody brought their best dish to the house during a funeral. So the people that had very little to eat at that period of time of wake, you know, it was a real feast.
And they did a bit of drinking too.
Oh, I think they did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they did.
Were there any traditional Irish sports or Irish festivities that you remember growing up?
You know, I truly don't. My father was a, you know, he worked all the life that I can remember him, so he worked hard, and the only things that I can remember doing, some of the traditions, that things that we had to do as far as things he demanded, was going to Mass on Sunday. That was a real given. You couldn't miss Mass. It was just a given in the house. And if you ever got anything new, the first place you wore it was to church. Like if you got something new on a Monday, whether it be a pair of shoes or a new coat or a pair of gloves, you had to wait till Sunday because the first place you could wear them was a church. So that was always a real anxious time if you got something as a gift or whatever. Early in the week, you had to wait till Sunday to wear it to church, and you always had to wear your best to church on Sunday. You couldn't go, you know, he was just mortified when women started wearing slacks and when you were allowed to not wear a hat in church. Those are the things I think were very difficult for that generation to accept, because it was just so against what they were grew up and what they believed, the lack of all of that old tradition.
The Latin Mass, even?
Yes, yeah.
What was your house like? How many rooms, how many rooms?
Our house was actually, it was a pretty decent home. It had two bedrooms with a doorway in between, and it had a front room and a dining room, which was, my father had knocked out the wall when I was a child, and I remember making it one big room. And we had a kitchen and a bathroom and a back porch and a front porch. So it was a pretty decent house. When my dad was born and raised in that house, they had the 10 kids, of course, and they only had their folks' bedroom and the one other bedroom, so they had five girls sleeping in one bed and the four boys sleeping in the other bed, because they lost a brother at an early age. He was about 10, so they spent most of their years just sleeping like logs of wood in a bed because they never had any other beds for them to sleep in.
But then did you have a bedroom of your own?
I did early on. No, I didn't actually. I shared it with my brother. And then I had my tonsils removed when I was 7, and he wouldn't let me in there anymore, so they got a rollaway, and I had to sleep in the dining room because I snored. And he told me one night he was going to roll me down the road to Hobart's if I didn't stop snoring. Well, I couldn't help that in my rollaway bed.
Where did you shop for groceries?
We shopped all the years that I was at home and with my mom. We went to the Safeway on Granite Street. So we knew generations of people working in Safeway. That's the only place we went. And then my mother walked to town every single day, and she had something in layaway every place, whether it be a hat or a pair of earrings or something. She paid like a quarter a week, and then we'd get groceries, and my father would drive down after work, and he had this little teeny, it was a coin thing that was like a football. I don't know if you remember those little
footballing shaped
little, and that was his mad money, and it was full of dimes. So he would park the car. He would go over to the Butte Brewery and get a beer. My mother and I would, if I met her after school or something, we'd walk over from Safeway after we put the groceries in the car and go into the Butte Brewery. And he'd have a little pouch, and it was full of dimes, and the beers were a dime. My mother would have a highball, and then we'd head north. So basically, she was downtown almost every day, but my dad would come down most nights and pick her up till my brother learned how to drive, and then he would pick her up.
What do you remember about the Butte Brewery? Do you
remember? Oh, God, I was raised in the Butte Brewery. I remember the smell of yeast in the bathroom.
Yeah.
You'd go into the bathroom, and there was just this god-awful smell, and for years I didn't know what it was, but it was the yeast from the brewery on the other side of the wall that had permeated the walls.
Well, you didn't go into the brewery then. Where did you go?
We were in the bar.
Oh, there was a bar.
Oh, yes, there was a bar.
Tell us about the bar.
So we went to the bar. And the bathroom, the women's bathroom was on the right-hand side and the men's was on the north side. And it was a long, long bar. And before my time, they had a cage where they used to cash checks, and it was kind of like a early chain-link fence, but it was up in a bay window that faced the street. And I can remember being in that cage asleep for hours while my mother and my father were entertaining themselves in the bar with everybody from the neighborhood, and everybody that we knew was in the Butte Brewery. So we spent a lot of time there, and I ate a lot of Hershey bars. I remember the bartenders. We were kind of related to Bill Lowney, who owned it with Tommy Cal, and we were related to Tommy Cal, who owned a Tommy Harrington. And so it was kind of like a family joint. We just spent a lot of time there. But I can remember just praying that, God, aren't they going to go home soon? And then I just go over and fall asleep in the corner. They had tables and chairs in there that were later became antiques. They were the ice cream chairs with the pretzel backs on them. And there was like a line of those on the north side of the bar, but lots of hours in the Viewbury.
Remember the spittoons?
Yes, mm-hmm. The spittoons.
Mm-hmm. The jukebox.
And the mm-hmm. jukebox, mm-hmm. exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's go on then. What kind of chores did you do around the house, if any? Probably didn't.
You know, I think I did. I had responsibilities like dumping the garbage, things like that. But my mother was a stay-at-home mom, so she, you know, had everything done by the time we got home from school. And so I really didn't do much. I think took the garbage out, maybe helped shovel the snow, basically things like that.
Did you burn your garbage?
No, we threw. We did have a trash can out in the back, but we also had a mini dump that you could throw some things over. Everybody had a dump. Private dump of your own.
What were your strongest memories of St. Mary's School?
One of my strongest memories was I was forced to take music lessons, and the sister was Sister Accordia, and myself and Marie Daly, who was a very good student and a very talented woman, girl at the time, and I had none of those strong suits. And so we had a piano, and I was supposed to be practicing. Well, I think it took me like 3 years to find middle C, but Marie was playing the mass by then. So we were supposed to have some kind of a test, and Sister Accordia was very demanding that you had to be able to pass this test. And I went in and told her that I had forgotten my music book. And so she called for my brother. So it had to be early in school because he was gone in 52, so it had to be first or second grade. And so he had to come up and talk to her, so he had a witness that I had forgotten my book, and so he was pretty agreeable. He agreed that yes, that I'd forgotten my music book. So they said, we'll get Marie Daly's. You can take the test on Marie Daly's. Well, I got so nervous, I threw up on her book. So for the rest of the year, I had to use the throw-up book. And Marie got my brand new one that didn't even have dog ears on it because I never opened it. And then I had to finish the year with the throw-up music book and never did get any better. So that's probably an outstanding memory.
So you're not a musician today?
No, I can't even whistle.
What did you do for family outings and holidays?
Holidays were always held at our house. My mother did all the dinners, Easter, Thanksgiving, Christmas. Any kind of a festivity was always done at my house because the only other relatives we really had was Jewel and Sharon and Danny, and Jewel didn't cook, so my mother always did dinner. So we always had huge dinners, and my mother had china and crystal, and you only used it for those certain days, and you would have 4 days getting it. But before the dinner, she would always decide to remodel or wallpaper or do something, so it was always such a crisis getting prepared for these holiday dinners. It was painful, actually, getting ready for dinners, but then she would drag out all this stuff, and the table was magnificent, and then she wouldn't let anybody touch it, so it would take her like a week to get all this stuff washed, dried, put back in the china closets. But when I got married, I decided I wasn't going to bother with any of that fancy stuff, that I would just go ahead and get things that you could use every day and drop on the floor and not have a heart attack, because I remember how awful it was to try and cherish those wonderful pieces of china and crystal.
Yeah. Do you have any of them yourself now?
Actually, they're down at my brother's house.
Oh, very nice. Okay. Okay, Danielle, would you like to describe for us the neighborhood where you grew up?
Our neighborhood was pretty unique, actually. It was an open door policy in everybody's home. You never had a call and say, I'm coming over. You just kind of went. And most of the men in the neighborhood, the dads, all had nicknames. And so that was kind of a unique factor. You never knew anybody's proper name because they always had nicknames, which was my father's name was Daniel, but they called him Dooney and Skuck Shea and Plexi Olson and Harp O'Neill. And, you know, it was just a thing you grew up with. And then you go someplace and talk about these people and they say, Lord, what kind of names are those? You know, and I had uncles that my dad's sisters had married, and one was Chick and one was Gluck. And I tell everybody, my uncle the Chick is coming and my uncle Gluck is coming. They say, Lord, what is a Chick and a Gluck? And I said, they're my uncles. You know, so they all, everybody, it was a real common thing for nicknames. And most of the people in the neighborhood, and that's how you identified them, because everybody had the same name. Like there was so many Sullivans, there'd be Jerry Sullivans, and there was a Jer above and a Jer below, because they were two different families, and that's how you described what Sullivan you were talking about. So they had to put some kind of a name so that when you were discussing families or persons, they could identify who it was you were talking to. And the gulch was sparse. I mean, there was nothing. There was hardly any grass. We did have grass. Hogarth's didn't have grass. Sullivan's didn't have grass. Lee's didn't have grass. Lee's almost didn't have a house. It was just an old boarding house, and they had an uncle that lived upstairs, and
his name
was Jex.
What was his real name?
I think his proper name might have been John, I don't know, but we always called him Jex. Yeah. And Jex used to summer well, and he wore bib overalls without a shirt, and one day you'd see him out in the right arm, the strap on the bibs was off, then the next day the other strap was off, so we'd get an even suntan. And my father always used to kid about Jex that he thought he had Confederate bills under his mattress because he lived pretty frugally. But
he did have money too, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah, the Shea girls, I think, benefited well from that. But yeah, Dooney always said he had federal or Confederate bills under his mattress.
What were the houses like? You know, like, draw us a verbal picture of what that Dublin Gulch looked like.
Well, we had two streets in the gulch that covered everybody's address, and it was called Summit Street or Ridgely. Ida Sullivan's house was up on Ridgely, and it was a two-story house with a front porch. And over the years of the boys growing up, they had the house sided finally. They got enough money to side the house, and the guy took down the steps, and they never rebuilt the steps, so you couldn't come off the second floor other than if you went through the house. And
was there still a door there?
Yeah, this door was still there. You could go out and stand on the porch, but there was no place to go from the porch. And then our house was fairly decent, and then the Hartmans lived next door to us, and it was a two-story house. And it had been a two-family home at one time, but they never ever painted it. They were Finlanders, actually, that lived next door to us, and they were wonderful people. And so they never had painted their house all the years we were there. And the Maloneys lived in...
Was it brick?
No, it was wood. And it was kind of painted gray, and it had been all the shiplap of the boards had begun to peel and split over the years, and the front porch was basically falling off. They didn't have indoor plumbing until we were in probably high school. And the youngest of the girls that would be your age slept
Rosemary.
In a crib till she was about in the sixth grade because they didn't have any beds. And Charlie was a piece of work. He had, every time somebody was throwing away a mattress, he took the mattress and put it on his bed. And his bedroom was wallpapered in cardboard boxes.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a great treat. You almost had a pole vault into bed. Plus, there was a clothesline in his room. And you almost had a pole vault to the bed. And when you get on top of this bed, you could lay there and read all the boxes. You know, like it was Wheaties or Oxidol or something. So it was kind of a geography lesson to sit there in a reading lesson to read the walls and read the ceilings.
Whatever happened to Rosemary?
They're in Dillon, as far as I know. Rosie married, Sylvia was there, and I think she relocated after her husband retired. But that house was right next to us, and Charlie was a hard rock miner. Used to drive a Chevrolet, and I can remember when they got their 55 Chevy, and it was like a Cadillac in those days, because they had driven like a 37 Chevy all those years I was growing up. And Maloney's were on the south side of that. It used to be a family by the name of Ball when my brother and then we're living, and then Helen and Neil bought it. And then Hogarth's were kind of down on one corner, still Summit Street, and then Cernich's, and then Dennehy's and Scuckshay. And Barry's were up on the hill, and they were still Summit Street. Lee's were on Summit. Plexi Olson was on Summit. Harp O'Neill was on Summit. So Ida was the only street in the entire neighborhood, and it was kind of like a bowl. In the wintertime, my father would shovel the road as the snow fell, and then he would get to the bottom. It would take him all 4 or 5 hours to get to the bottom, and then we would be on the top of the hill kicking the snow back on so we could sleigh ride. And to get the car, it was the only house in the world that you had to get up to it and up to get out of it. I mean, it was just It was sitting on a perch, and it was horrendous. You had to go about 60 miles an hour around the first corner. Hope you didn't hit Hogarth's house. Make the next corner by Maloney's house and kind of just swish into the flat part by the garage. It was a ride and a half up that road.
Are you talking about the sleigh ride or the car ride?
The car, the automobile. That was getting the car home. But it was kind of like a bowl, and the houses were all, you know, double hip roofs, and most of them had a front porch.
When did you leave that neighborhood?
I left there in 1973 when I got married.
And what was it like then?
It was basically the same that it had been for probably 20 years prior to that. Nobody ever moved in, and there were just everybody would still have been there, except the Anaconda Company came in and bought the home, so we all had to relocate. And it was really a tragedy, I think, as far as the women, like my mother and Ann Lee and Ida and Helen Hogarth, and then because they were so close for all the years of raising their children, and once they relocated them into different areas of town, telephoning wasn't sufficient to keep them together because they used to visit and walk into each other's homes. So it made a huge difference in that closeness of all of those ladies.
Mm-hmm.
So it was even though they ended up with way better homes and in nicer neighborhoods, they basically ended up kind of not as close as they used to be because none of them drove. So they couldn't get around to see each other. Helen Maloney was the only lady in the Gulch that drove.
And they lost their neighborhood, didn't they?
Yeah.
What happened to the houses once the ACM bought the houses?
They didn't move any of them. They left them vacant for a few years, then the company came in and bulldozed them all over.
So when they ask, has your neighborhood changed over the years? It has indeed.
It has disappeared.
No longer exists.
Yep, and I told you I was up looking at it the other day, and it's really even hard to visualize where your house was, and you would think you wouldn't forget that because there was, you know, landmarks that you would thought you would have remembered, but standing there looking at it, I had a tough time trying to picture just where my house was. And then when you're younger, it looks so much bigger, and all of a sudden you're looking at it now, and it's been dumped on and moved and bulldozed in different directions, so it's really hard to stand there. It was rather nostalgic, actually, a little sad, quite sad.
And one thing we didn't talk on, you said the ACM company bought the houses. What did most of the people do for a living?
Most everybody that worked or that lived in the Gulf, the dads usually worked in the mine. One of the guys worked at the post office. Plexi Olson worked at a gas station. Most of the other guys, the Dennehys, they were crafts. They worked for the Anaconda Company. The Kellys worked for the Anaconda Company. And then Helen Hogarth was a widow, I guess you wouldn't call her a widow, but she was without a husband for lots of years. She went to work at the courthouse.
And Randall used to show up to buy a haircut.
Yeah. But, you know, I can remember when we were kids for the 4th of July. We had a big celebration in the Gulch because we used to get catalogs. I don't know if you guys remember them, the little catalogs that come out and you could buy fireworks. And they started out with a box that was this big for $2.99, you get a box this big for $6.99. Well, if you had $20, you could get better
huge
than the big
box.
End. So everybody in the Gulch, Randall Hogarth included, every family got a box of those things. And absolutely the best 4th of July. So we chewed off our fireworks long before the Big M ever started. So then we'd all parade over the road and sit on the Black Rocks facing the Big M above Crowley's and watch the big fireworks. But once when I was young and Hare was a macho lad, and he insisted on having my mother's apron to put his firecrackers in. And they used to have cherry bombs. I don't know if you remember cherry bombs. And they had zebra firecrackers, and they had other sparklers and all this stuff. So he's out in the yard throwing this stuff. Well, his punk dropped into with the apron, was blowing him up. My mother, he's running through the yard. My mother's running after him, trying to catch him to get, because it had like an X in the back. And then it went around your way. She's trying to get it off of him. And it is blowing these cherry bombs. The ape was blowing up in the front. And she's screaming, Jimmy, Jimmy, stop, Jimmy. Oh, Lord. By the time she got him, he was almost fried. I'm surprised he was able to fight the children, actually. It should have ruined him for life.
They'd blow a toilet up. Or
they would. They'd blow a can up 50 feet. Yeah, so that was pretty exciting. He was
great stories.
He was interesting. He got shot when he was 9.
Wow. By whom?
by Jimmy Sheehan.
Oh.
They had all, the big boys had all gotten 22s for Christmas. And so Danny Sullivan and Hare really wanted to shoot those guns. So they had to earn being able to shoot the guns.
Uh-huh.
So what they had to do was set targets. So they were setting targets for them, setting up pop bottles so the boys could shoot. And so they were busy setting up the targets, and after they'd all shoot the bottles, and they had another case that they load. And so Hare was bent over, picking up bottles, and Jimmy Sheehan's gun went off accidentally and shot him in the neck.
Oh.
And so Danny Sullivan called my mother, and he said, Margaret, and she said, yeah, and she said, he said, Jimmy's been shot. And he said, where? And he said, up on the hill. Well, looking out of our house up on the hill, I mean, we were like in a valley of hills. And so my mother became panicky. My dad was at work, so she didn't know where to go looking for him. And Danny hung up, and he ran home, I guess, scared to death. And so by the time Hara got home, he had walked from wherever he was shot up behind Ida's house someplace. And he was holding onto his neck. And I can remember him seeing it, and they keep telling me I don't remember, but I do remember. He was holding his neck, and the blood was dripping off his elbows. My mother said to him, Jimmy, you ruined your tennis shoes. They're covered in blood.
And oh, then, those were expensive shoes, perhaps.
Well, yeah, there were those black ones with the big eyelets on them. And so then they took him to the hospital and couldn't find it, so they decided that he got hit by a piece of rock, that it really didn't go in. So then they turned him over, and they found the bullet in his back, but they were afraid to touch it because they thought it would move and go into his lung and kill him. So when he died 2 years ago, the bullet was still in him.
Oh, my God. And yeah, how old was he when he died?
Nine. Oh, no, when he died?
When he died.
71.
Oh, my gosh. Really carried around a memory. I wonder if he could make it through the airport.
He could. It was a little hunk of lead that encapsulated in whatever, but he couldn't make it in the service. They rejected him for the service, and all of his buddies were going to the service, and he was devastated.
Oh. Well, I got one last question. If you were to write the history of the Irish in Butte, what would you include if you were doing this for future generations? The history of the Irish.
The history of the Irish. I guess I would say that they're probably the most generous prevaricators I've ever met in my life.
Please explain your answer.
They love to exaggerate. They love a good story. And they love a good party.
Yeah. It was fun growing up in Butte, wasn't it?
It was great. Truly, it was a fun time of life.
Thank
it
you.
Is a fun time.
It is, isn't it? Thank you, Dennis.
Mm-hmm.
You all go on the ladies.